Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Labor, Workplace, and Regulated Industries. Good to see you all this morning. The first thing we're going to do is approve the minutes. So, Representative Simonson, you want to move the minutes?
So moved.
Minutes are moved. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor indicate by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The minutes are approved. First thing we have on our agenda today is an overview of a department that I don't know much about, and I'm hoping to learn something. And if you want to come right up to the desk, sir, and we'll start off with an overview of the Minnesota Bureau of Mediation Services. So welcome to the committee. If you just identify yourself for the record and start up.
My name is Josh Tilson. I'm the Commissioner of the Minnesota Bureau of Mediation Services. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thanks for asking me to come in and tell you a little bit about what we do this morning. Essentially, BMS is the state agency that's responsible for administering Minnesota's labor relations laws. That's our primary brief. We administer Minnesota Statutes 179 and 179A. Which is Minnesota's Public Employment Labor Relations Act and Minnesota's Labor Relations Act, which covers certain private sector employees. We regulate the labor and management relations between Minnesota's more than 1,700 public employers, their employees, and their exclusive representatives. That's basically our main mission. BMS was created in 1939 to administer the MLRA, which was newly adopted during the middle of the Depression, or actually at the end of the Depression. This law covered only private sector employees and publicly owned hospitals. It did not affect public sector employees. At that time, really, collective bargaining had no place in state government until 1971. In 1971, the Minnesota legislature enacted the Minnesota Labor Relations Act, and that's been the biggest part of what we've done since the 70s. Today, the mission of the Bureau of Mediation Services is as follows. To promote stable and collective constructive labor management relations and the use of alternative dispute resolution in public policy disputes other than labor management. Now, what I want to really talk to you about is kind of who we are. BMS is the smallest cabinet-level agency in the state. There is no commissioner who will come before you who has a smaller budget or fewer employees than the Minnesota Bureau of Mediation Services. In fiscal year 2002, the BMS budget was about $2.2 million. And by 2012, our budget was $1.58 million, a reduction of about 28%. So we've just been getting smaller and smaller in the last 10 years, although this is a trend I know throughout government, but it's been particularly severe in an agency as small as we are. Nonetheless, BMS is, because of the wide scope of our jurisdiction, we have a great impact. What I like to say is our impact is outsized for the size of our budget. And the reason for this is due to the broad scope, the numbers of employees that we work with, and public employers. One of the biggest costs for public employers is, guess what? Employee costs, right? So we work with all of the state's employers, and because we have an effect on those, we have an outsized impact on the cost for state jurisdictions. I put together a small flyer for you. You'll see it in your little packet I handed out. And if you just take a look at it, what it points out is that we deal with the state executive branch and all of its employees, the state courts, all the 340 school districts in Minnesota, more than 70 special boards and commissions, such as the Met Council and the Metropolitan Airports Commission, all of the state's 1,200 cities, towns, and municipalities, all of the state's 87 counties, the University of Minnesota, and the 31 public colleges of the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities system. Minnesota has about 260,000 public employees, and about 72% of those are represented by unions or exclusive representatives, and they are represented in about 3,550 bargaining units. A bargaining unit is essentially a contract. It's a group of employees that bargains together as a group. So, I don't know if I said this, but I mean, what I like to say is we punch above our weight. We have a lot more impact than you would think for the tiny little size that we have. The mediators of the Bureau of Mediation Services work with all these groups on a demand basis, and We try to help them work through their problems with their unions. So we achieve our mission through several programs, which I'd like to just walk through real quickly for you, and I'll try to make it as quick as I can so you have time for some questions and so forth. Our first program that we administer is called Labor Mediation, and really it's in our name, and it's what we mainly do. Mediation is really a process whereby disputing parties are assisted by a trained, neutral third party in reaching a voluntary agreement. Most of the mediation BMS does is either contract mediation or grievance mediation. Contract mediation is the process of when an employer and a union aren't able to reach agreement by direct negotiations across the table, they can petition the Bureau to send in a mediator to try to help them get their contracts resolved. Similarly, grievance mediation occurs when management and labor are unable to resolve a disagreement over the application of or adherence to their terms, to the terms and conditions of an existing collective bargaining agreement. Similarly, they can petition the Bureau and we'll send somebody out to try to help them get it worked out, and we do a lot of that. The second program we administer is called representation. Simply put, representation is the process of determining if employees wish to be represented by a particular union or not. We do that through elections. We also have to determine which jobs are grouped together for the purposes of collective bargaining in this process. So we have four main types of work we do in this area, and I'll just run through them real quickly. One is new certification. That's when a union is seeking to organize an unorganized group of employees. So we'll go in and investigate, and you'd normally conduct an election. The second type is what we call decertification. That is when a group of already organized employees is seeking to go from being represented to being unrepresented. They're asking to remove their exclusive representative. They petition our office, and we do an investigation and normally conduct an election, and similarly to when there's a certification petition. The third type, and really what we do a lot of work in, is an area called unit clarification. And these occur when there are new jobs created or jobs are combined, and the parties can't agree what bargaining units they go in or the size or scope of the bargaining units. We'll come in and do an investigation, oftentimes have an administrative hearing, and then issue an order as to the scope of the existing bargaining unit. And then finally, the last thing we're doing, and we're doing a lot more these days of these than we had in recent years, but something called challenges. Challenges are where a group of employees is represented by a current exclusive representative, and they're asking to switch to a different exclusive representative. So Union A is challenging Union B. That's what we call them, challenge petitions. The next thing I want to talk briefly about is labor management cooperative programs. BMS actively promotes joint labor management partnerships. In this arena, labor and management work collaboratively to address problems seeking to improve their relationship or seeking to improve the operations of the organization. This is widely used in private industry. It goes by a number of different kinds of names, but it's really a facilitated collaborative process where people take a look at existing problems that they have in the workplace and try to come up with solutions to problems that meet the interests of both sides. Then I want to talk about our arbitration roster. An arbitrator is a neutral, disinterested person, jointly selected, to hear and issue a final binding decision on both grievances and contract disputes. BMS maintains a roster of about 60 qualified arbitrators. And what I want to say about arbitrators only is this. This is something you read misquoted in the paper more than about anything else. When you read that it was a BMS arbitrator in the paper, they're not BMS arbitrators. We certify them and qualify them, but they're not state employees. They're private adjudicators who we maintain a list of them, their authority comes both through the PELRA, the MLRA, and through the Uniform Arbitration Act, but they are not state employees. Then I want to talk about training and technical support. Training is probably, in my opinion, one of the most cost-effective things we do. And the reason for that is because advocates who are skilled in conflict resolution and negotiation more often are able to resolve their disputes without resort to mediation services, arbitration, or other self-help methods that are available to the parties. And so we feel that training and teaching really reduces the need for our services. So we've been trying to put more of our efforts into teaching and training and doing conflict resolution promotion. We like to say, you give a person a fish and you feed them for a day, you know, same sort of thing. Teach a person to solve their own problems, they won't need us. That's kind of the theory that we operate on in that regard. I want to talk for a moment about the promotion of alternative dispute resolution in the areas outside labor management relations. Formerly, BMS had a program called the Office of Dispute Resolution, or ODR, which really was devoted to non-labor public policy and citizen dispute resolution. That program was defunded in 2003. And demand for these services did not go away. And the commissioner before me and myself as well have continued to try to do what we can when there are urgent public policy disputes and they need a trained mediator, and for some reason they can't or won't go to a private mediator. So we once in a while do this. It's a very small part of what we do anymore, but at one time we did quite a bit of mediations. The kind of stuff that this involves is I work for the Department of Transportation where there are disputes over the site of an off-ramp to a freeway, or disputes over setting up a runway. We do have some small interagency agreements with a couple of different state agencies, Transportation and Transportation and Society for the Blind. We used to do the Department of Human Rights. We don't do it anymore. But where we did basically mediation for those folks. We do very little of it just because our budget has shrunk so much. We don't really have the resources to offer what we used to be able to offer in that area. So those are the main programs that, that the BMS operates. I want to take just about five more minutes and talk to you about what I think are my accomplishments or our accomplishments in the first 2 years of the Dayton administration. Let me talk about first strike prevention. The main reason we were created is because there were a whole bunch of strikes going on. In the 30s and in the 70s, there were a lot of strikes going on around public sector. And those are the reasons that people really want mediators, because they don't want strikes. But also, strikes are expensive. So in 2012, BMS mediators resolved over 1,200 labor disputes with zero strikes. In fact, we haven't had any strikes for about 5 years. And we're quite proud of that. I mean, I won't take full credit for it. The economy is a big part of that reason, too. It'd be sort of foolish not to tell you that most public employees, for that matter, private employees, are very reluctant to strike in this economic atmosphere. But as a true matter, if you look at the BMS records going back 25 years, we've been very successful. There's Minnesota, public sector strikes are as rare as hen's eggs. You just don't see them very much, and we like to take some credit for that. Well, the credit is also due to the employers and the unions, but BMS is entitled to its fair share of the credit for preventing strikes throughout the state. The cost of a single strike, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics and the FMCS, is about $4 to $5 million for the average strike nationwide. So we think that's a big accomplishment. The second thing I want to talk about is dollars that are saved by averting arbitrations and litigation costs. And probably this is a more quantifiable thing. The reported cost of to public employers for a single arbitration or labor relations litigation is about $25,000. Now, when I say reported, actually we surveyed a bunch of employers and law firms to try to find out. And we're very conservative. If you've ever, I don't know if there's anybody here that practices labor or that has worked in labor relations or taken part in the labor arbitration, but $25,000 is cheap. Representative Simonson might be nodding his head over there knowing that. But in any event, my only point is that in fiscal year 2012, BMS mediation saved public employers significant millions of dollars beyond the cost of our budget in averted court actions and labor arbitration. Then the next thing I want to talk about is our efforts to improve efficiency. We found a number of ways to deliver quality services to our clients in the face of, you know, what I've already told you are reduced, you know, significantly reduced resources. It's really not possible to do more with less, but we're meeting the most important and urgent needs of the labor relations community. What we've done to try to save dollars is we've reduced support services, including administrative staff, accounting services, and IT support's been reorganized with the new technology changes in the state. We have a reduced number of mediators as well. We've made changes in the way we schedule cases in an effort to reduce travel time and make better use of staff resources. Also, I want to talk about staff morale. And I don't know if anybody else that comes before you is going to talk about this, but I want to talk about it just for a brief moment. Because of what we do, our most important output consists of direct hands-on delivery of problem solving for all units of Minnesota government and their employees and their exclusive representatives. This requires skilled and motivated professional mediators. When Governor Dayton appointed me to lead the BMS in 2012, the staff morale was very low. And this is due to the severe reduction in resources and the increasingly tough collective bargaining that had left many of our best mediators discouraged. I don't know if you remember, in 2011 is when all the disputes were going on in Wisconsin. The budget was in doubt. People weren't sure if we were going to be coming to work the next day. And morale was just low. It wasn't just the mediation service. It was true throughout government. And knowing that the governor supports what we do has made a big difference, and it's raised the morale of our employees. The work the mediators do requires long, irregular hours, frequent travel, and long nights, and tremendous patience. Today our staff knows that because they have the governor's support, they're sort of more willing to put in the extra effort that's required to get this work done. So that's pretty much it. We did make some significant changes in technology as well. And this area credits due to the prior administration, where they did put some funding into upgrading our technology, and we're trying to deliver more of our services online, particularly petition filing, access to our research materials, arbitration awards, BMS decisions, and other case administrative things. We're trying to do more electronically to save costs. So we have found some ways to cut money, and I want to give credit to the Minnesota MNIT services. They've really done wonderful. That technology consolidation has saved a lot of money and made the Bureau more efficient in terms of its ability to deliver its services to the people that we serve. So that's my little spiel. I'd be happy to answer any questions you all have.
Well, thank you, Mr. Tilson, for your presentation. And we do have a few questions from members, so we'll just start right off at that. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chairman. I just have two quick questions. How many FTEs does your agency have? And then also, you talked about decertification. How often does that actually happen, where you're decertifying a union?
Well, I just...
And Mr. Tilson, just go through the chair.
I beg your pardon.
No problem.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I thought that question would come up, and so I brought the numbers with me. The FTEs are 11 right now. I have my budget has requested a little additional help. When I didn't tell you this, but I've been with the Bureau for 25 years. And when I came to work here in the 80s, we had about 14 mediators and a total of about 27 employees. In 2002, we had about 18 employees. And when I took office, we had 11. And that's what we have today. We have 11 FTEs. Actually, we have a vacancy right now, but we have 11 FTEs. In terms of decertifications, we're seeing about 8 to 10 a year. If you want, and I can tell you that, for example, in FY 12, we saw about 47 new certifications, about 10 decertifications, and a 5 or 6 challenge elections is what we saw.
Representative O'Neill, follow up?
Yeah. Thank you, Chairman. And do you see a trend in that? Do you see, with the decertification, are you seeing an increase, a decrease over the last 10 years?
Mr.
Tilson.
Representative, I don't think so. When you say trend, I think it's steady. I don't think there are some years there are bumps. The one thing we have had a bump in actually is challenge elections. Doing a lot of challenge elections. There have been a couple of new unions formed in Minnesota in the last 5 years, and so there's been some of this going on. A lot of the unions are independent. They're not affiliated with any union. There are quite a few unions in Minnesota that are independent. A group of employees gets together and forms their own union, and they're not affiliated with the big unions you've heard of, like Teamsters or AFSCME or so forth. And we've had a little bump in the number of independent unions, and that some of those have challenged other unions for the representation rights. But it's a really small bump. It's not like it's been a significant change.
Thank you.
Representative Blaine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, as you know that I'm very interested in mediation, and I took a conflict resolution course myself, and would you talk a little bit about how mediation has helped over the years, for instance, back with the farm foreclosures and other things that used to go on in the office, and how effective mediation is, both not only in cost savings but in relationship savings?
Mr. Tilson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lane, this is a long story, and I'll try to keep it as short as I can. Over the years, because we have mediation in our name, although it's not our primary mission, we get a lot of requests for mediation in areas other than labor. And at one time, the state had an office that actually used to be housed in state planning way back when there was a state planning office going back, I think, 20 years. But it was eventually moved over to the Bureau of Mediation Services. And we had calls for a lot of different kinds of mediation, particularly, I think, you mentioned the farm foreclosure program. That actually predated the state planning office. At one time, BMS oversaw and maintained a list of qualified arbitrators to try to resolve farm foreclosures. We have also done training for mediators who do mortgage foreclosure. actions. And the thing that the reason that those are useful is because most of these kinds of things, if litigated, outweigh the value of whatever the issue is that the parties are fighting over. It makes it very difficult on certain parties to spend the money to litigate. So a great deal of savings is due there. Another area where we did quite a bit at one time was the Department of Human Rights. A lot of money gets goes into human rights complaints, and then the court actions that often follow those. So we've been very successful in doing that. Today, that operation is actually run by the Department of Human Rights itself. Let me see.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lane.
Thank you. I will be actually bringing forth a bill to expand, to refund this Office of Dispute Resolution. And we looked at various places in order to house it and decided that refunding that office is the best place to put mediators that could help in a larger sense across the state. Right now, they're very effective in, for instance, Hennepin County, where they participate in harassment court and housing court and save the court a huge amount of costs by taking care of business before the person has to go before the judge. The judge will just say, have you mediated? And then they go and mediate and they can solve it. Not only, though, I want to emphasize, not only excellent cost savings, but also if it's, for instance, a neighborhood dispute, you save the relationship in the neighborhood, or a family dispute, you actually have people come around and have very effective, I call it community saving as well as money savings. So, but the savings in the cost are very large. And the commissioner here has agreed to work with us in adding it to his area. At the same time, I want to emphasize that he has the smallest budget in the state, and we do not want to impose on that anymore. We want to add to it, not impose on that. The work they do is impressive, and we want to make it available across the state to police, to schools, to counties, to cities, that when they have a dispute, they know where to go and where they can get help. And this would operate through nonprofit organizations that do mediation, but they need the grants, and we need somebody to service the grants. So we're looking at adding that to his workload. At the same time, we need to add, not subtract. So I bring that forth.
Thank you, Representative Lane. Representative Kiefer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Some of the questions have been answered for me, but I just need a little extra education on this because you were talking really fast. So an arbitrator is different than a mediator. An arbitrator is private.
Mr. Tilson.
Chair, Representative, thanks for asking me to clarify that. I probably blew through it too fast. A mediator brings the parties together for voluntary settlement, and they do not have the authority to make any decisions. All right, a mediator is a person who stands between the parties and says, let's keep talking. Here are some ideas for settlement. What are the most important things to you? They say that to each side. Try to help them mesh what we call their interests. Try to find places where their interests overlap to help them reach settlement voluntarily. The authority under Peller for a mediator is simply to bring the only power a mediator has, or I have as commissioner of the Bureau, is to get the parties to the table and keep them at the table. If you read the law, the one thing it says is that the parties have to stay at the table at the call of the commissioner. And we exercise that authority. We make them sit there and negotiate. And that's how we get a lot of our cases settled. Arbitration, by contrast, is a litigation. It's an adjudication. And it normally, it always involves arbitrators who are an independent practitioner of labor arbitration. We qualify and maintain them through a set of rules that we maintain, and under the statute we're required to maintain a list of up to 60 arbitrators. These arbitrators will be selected jointly by the parties from a list provided from our office, and they will schedule a hearing, come out and hear evidence, take a documentary evidence, witnesses, and issue a binding ruling. And under the PELRA and the Uniform Arbitration Act, the decision of an arbitrator is final and binding. So the simplest way to think about it is that a mediator tries to promote voluntary settlement and an arbitrator issues a binding award.
Follow-up, please.
Representative Kiefer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is the mediator part of your FTE and they're not?
Sure.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, they are not. They don't work for us. We don't pay them anything. In fact, they pay us to be on the list. We have a small administrative fee to be listed every year. The arbitrators are private citizens. Almost all of the states that have unions, plus the federal government, maintain lists of qualified arbitrators throughout the country. as well as there are a couple of commercial organizations. The most notable one is the American Arbitration Association that maintain lists of qualified arbitrators. These folks are essentially little private businesses, and what they do for a living is adjudicate disputes. They do it not only in labor. Many of them work in various commercial areas as well.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kiefer.
Sorry, I think you answered arbitrators. They're the private ones that actually pay you guys. So the mediators, they're...
The mediators work for the Bureau of Mediation. Pardon me.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the mediators are employees of the Bureau of Mediation Services. Okay. Today we have seven FTE mediators and three support staff. But the mediators are employees of the state of Minnesota.
Thank you.
Very good. Representative Simonson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Tilson, maybe just a comment followed by a question, if I may. I just want to speak to the value of the BMS from a personal standpoint. I have had the opportunity to use the services of the BMS on a number of times over the years, and I would say 8 out of 10, maybe 9 out of 10 times that we've used the BMS, we were able to avoid arbitration, which is an underscored value, as you touched on. Cost of an arbitration for both sides does escalate $20,000-$25,000. So if a mediator comes in and is able to resolve an issue or a dispute without having both sides proceed to arbitration, we can save significant amounts of money. But that being said, I just want to speak to the credit of the BMS and to your employees. But my question is about, you talked about the decrease in staff over the last 10 years. And my question is, and I didn't hear you touch on this, but tell me about backlog. I'm sure you have a number of requests for mediation, as I know that there's a number of well, there's many contracts throughout the state, but I'm just curious as if there's a backlog based on this reduction in staff over the last 10 years.
Mr. Tilson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the work of the Bureau of Mediation Services is cyclical. So during the high, what happens is contracts tend to expire at the end of the fiscal year and at the end of the calendar year. And our workload ramps up 3 or 4 months before that in each cycle. And so we go through really busy periods and somewhat lean periods. Actually, at the moment, we're in one of our lean periods. But when we're in our busy periods, the busiest periods we have is teacher season, when all the teacher contracts expire on June 30th of each odd-numbered year. That drives our caseload up by hundreds of, at a time. And we then always have a large backlog, and the mediators are really busy. Over the years, we've had times when people have had to schedule, you know, meetings in two or three towns in the same day and, you know, run from one mediation to another. Because of the crunch of, so the answer is we have a backlog in the high season, but now, as always, in the low season, we don't. So we try to make use of that. The other thing about backlog is in our hearings division, our representation cases are chronically backlogged because, I think because of administrative problems that we're having in the agency and because of over-lawyering. And one of the things we've run into in the last 10 years is a lot of these union certification or decertification cases are over-lawyered. They're very difficult to mediate settlements to because they are an existential crisis for whoever's dealing with it, and they, you know, they basically go to the wall on those issues. We see a lot of extensive legal process which delays those things.
Representative Simonson.
Thank you for that. And my final question is about the Public Employees Insurance Program. Are you involved in that in terms of requests for bargaining units to become a part of that or opt into that program, if you will?
Mr. Tilson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Simonson, yes, we are. It's fairly frequent, especially in school districts, but we have cases that involve counties and cities as well. It's a complex question. I don't know how many of you folks have focused on this, but one of the biggest problems that we see as mediators, of course, is the cost of health care. It's a big driver. I mean, there's just a trade-off. There's only a limited amount of money in any settlement, and it's a trade-off between how much money you want to spend paying for health care and how much money you want to pay for other things. And employees in general, everybody, and whether they're unionized or non-unionized, really want belt and suspenders on their health care. People want to be overinsured. That's one of the things we've learned over the years is people want us, they tend to spend more money on insurance and even at the expense of spending less on salaries and other things. And it's not a good thing. So, but the Public Employees Insurance Program is a program where a public employer can go to join the essentially the CGIP pool, as I understand it, although their pool's outside of it, but it's managed and administered by the state. And if a group of employees asks to go to CGIP, the current statute requires that they be permitted to do so if they vote to do so. And that comes up in cases on a, not all the time, but a fairly frequent basis. Yes.
Very good. Members, we will complete this overview by no later than 9 o'clock so we can get Dolly's testimony as well. But we have a few more people with questions. Representative Savick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Tellisman, I have a multi-question here. What role does the BMS have, if any, in the union's right to strike and the employer's right to lock out? And are there employees who can't strike?
Mr. Tillson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sarek, all right. What role does the BMS have in an employee's right to strike?
Mm-hmm.
Under the statute, and I do not have the statute in front of me, and I should know all this by heart after all these years, but no employee in Minnesota can strike unless they have first mediated for at least 45 days and given a 10-day notice or a cooling-off period notice to the Bureau and had received a letter from the Commissioner that they've met those requirements, and then they get, under the law, they get a strike window, which is typically 10 days, so they have 10 days on which to exercise the right to strike. Most public employees in Minnesota, I think, have the right to strike. The exceptions are what the law deems to be essential employees. Essential employees are pretty much who you think they'd be, plus a bunch of other people. So the obvious ones are police and fire. In Minnesota, labor relations law also permits supervisors to organize, and supervisors are prohibited from striking. Minnesota law permits county attorneys and principals and school districts to organize, and they have no right to strike. They can only arbitrate. Most of the managerial and supervisory classes, if they organize, can't strike. So I wish I had brought the statute with me. I could read the list. But under Minnesota statute 179.8.03, there's a list of who is essential. Mm-hmm. Everybody else has the right to strike. The biggest group that has the right to strike, aside from the state executive branch employees, most of the state executive branch employees are K-12 teachers and other school district employees.
Very good. Representative Sarah?
Yes, a point. What is the employer's right to lock out?
Mr. Tillson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, they don't have one.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, very good. Representative Benson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, are the mediators part of the bargaining unit, a public employees bargaining unit?
Oh, no.
Mr. Tillson.
Oh, sorry, excuse me. Mr. Chairman, Representative, no. you probably know this. If you don't, I can tell you that all of the, we are state employees, state executive branch employees, and all of the state employees are under compensation groups. But there are several compensation groups that are not permitted to unionize. The employees of the Bureau of Mediation Services are under what's known as the Commissioner's Plan. And if you read PELRA in its definition section, it defines public employees. It actually defines them by exclusion. So it says every person appointed or employed by a public employer is a public employee, except, and it has a big long list of about, I don't know, 20 exclusions. And one of those is employees of the Bureau of Mediation Services.
Representative Benson, follow.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, that was actually a leading question. I guess I knew that, but it was a matter of getting to a previous question regarding backlogs. I've taken the conflict resolution training and waiting to do my couple of visit alongs, you know, with mediation people that are already mediators in cases. I think I'm scheduled on the 25th to go into the housing court. But there are a number of people, from my understanding, that are on the list. They paid the fee to be on the qualified neutrals list. So if you're in a backlog, could you not potentially have pre-qualified some of those individuals for the kind of cases that come before your purview and use them in order to augment your staff so that you could maybe mitigate, so to speak, the backlogs when it's really difficult?
Mr. Tillson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, let me tell you my thoughts on that. We do use what we refer to as ad hoc mediators. We do that now, but we're pretty choosy about who we use. Every area has its own quirks and quirks, but labor relations is a special animal. I think that we could use ad hocs more in the areas of non-labor mediation. In the areas of labor mediation, we feel that we need people that have bargained a collective bargaining agreement before. We have some fairly stringent requirements. I'm going to give you my 2 second, well, we'll call it, it's called 15 second explanation about how we think about labor relations mediation. Any conflict can generally be charted on two axes. One axis is the importance of the what you're negotiating over, whether it's money or whether it's how much, well, the example I always use is, I have a relationship with my 16-year-old daughter who wants to go out and party all night on Friday nights, all right? And we negotiate over how late she's going to stay out. And I have a very strong interest in my relationship with my daughter. I also have a very strong interest in the substance of that dispute. That is to say, I don't want her to get hurt, I want her to be safe, and I don't want her to get arrested. And so I have a strong motivation to collaborate with her. If, on the other hand, I'm negotiating for a new car, and I don't anticipate that I'm going to be buying a new used car again from that same person, I really have no interest in the relationship at all, but my interest is primarily in what kind of a deal I can get for my car. So in labor relations, these are permanent relationships, and the relationship is almost as important as the substance of the relationship, or at least it ought to be. And we need mediators that understand that and that have learned that through practice to do labor mediation. That's what we've kind of determined over the years. And so the answer to your question is, we do use some ad hoc mediators, but mostly they're ones who already are experienced labor relations practitioners.
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, and last comment and question.
Sure, thank you. Ad hoc by ad hoc, I know that all the people on the list that volunteer for conflict resolution centers are unpaid. They're volunteers. Are your ad hocs paid?
Mr. Chairman. Chilson. I'm Representative, yes, they are.
Okay. And secondly, the last question, Mr. Chair, thank you for the indulgence.
Benson.
Simply in a matter of trying to overcome, if it's very cyclical in terms of, you know, when you're needed to add an FTE on all year round when you could use ad hocs, could it not be a strategy? I understand your need to have people that have some experience in labor negotiations. However, my limited training in mediation is one where the mediator really has no stake, and it's simply to manage the process, and that the participants themselves are the folks who come up with the resolutions necessary to overcome the reason why they're there. So it's not so incumbent upon the mediator necessarily to know everything about each party's particulars, just enough so that they can manage. So I'll leave it with a comment, and that maybe we might see a little bit more of that, in terms of helping you at least navigate through, and as a way to potentially make your office, I know it's very efficient now if you've seen cuts since 2001, but continue that with those efficiencies. Thank you.
Very good. And we will have one more question from Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, how are the mediators paid? You say they're paid when you bring people. How are they paid, and where does their salary come from?
Mr. Tilson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the full-time mediators of the Bureau of Mediation Services are employees of the executive branch, and they're compensated from our budget, which comes from the general fund.
Representative Nelson?
Then how are the ones that you bring in, the ones that are on your list, the ad hoc ones, paid?
Mr. Tilson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, they're pretty much paid the same way we pay them a daily rate. If I can explain a little more, we've always maintained a sort of a hardcore cadre of full-time mediators. And the number has fluctuated somewhat over the years, but I've sort of determined that the minimum number of people that we need to make the office run smoothly, especially with our increasing adjudication load. A lot of these mediators, and this might clarify some of what I was talking about before, are also double as administrative hearing officers in unit determinations and unit clarification. And so when they're not busy doing mediations, a number of them are out serving as hearing officers and trying to resolve disputes over union representation.
Representative Ellsworth.
And well, then the people that are coming to the arbitration, how are they charging? What do they pay, and what is their cost to them?
Mr. Chairman, Representative
Mr. Tilson,
the way that works is that when the parties can't settle something, whether they have or have not been to arbitration, they petition my office to send them a list of names of arbitrators, and they, under the law, take that list, and usually under the terms of their collective bargaining, take that list and select from that list a name who is the arbitrator. They contact that arbitrator, they schedule an arbitration, and their costs, the parties to the dispute are obligated to pay that arbitrator, and of course each side has to pay their own representatives' fees. Typically the biggest cost of going to arbitration is paying the representatives. It's usually more than what it costs to pay the arbitrator. The cost of legal fees and expenses and so forth. But that's really entirely under the jurisdiction of the arbitrator, under PELRA, and under the state's Uniform Arbitration.
Very good. And this will be the last question. Representative Kiefer.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'll make it quick. On your budget, out of the $1.5 million, is this only state money? Is there additional federal money that should be included in this number that you get for your department or the service bureau?
Mr. Tilson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, all of our money that we have for our general budget comes from the general fund. There is a small amount of money we get because we charge for some of our trainings. We don't have a revolving fund where we can charge parties for mediation services or for arbitration, but we do have a fund where we charge for our training services. There was a lot of discussion over the years as to the idea of charging the parties, and it's been considered by previous legislators. The problem that I think, and the objection that was raised to this, was that these are mandated services. They are mandated to proceed to arbitration or mediation under conditions under the statute. And if you require the parties then to pay for them, what you're really doing is shifting the cost from the general fund to the local units of government. And previous legislators didn't want to do that.
Okay, so just to clarify, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Kiefer.
So there's no federal money that you receive?
Mr. Tilson.
Chairman, Representative, none.
Oh, okay, thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Tilson, for your testimony. Obviously, a lot of energy around some of the issues that you presented, and appreciate your willingness to come forward and present them. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next on the docket is Commissioner Peterson. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Excuse me.
You have about 45 minutes there, Commissioner, so...
I'm a fast talk. We'll be done in five.
Identify yourself to record, please, and go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Ken Peterson, Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry. Mr. Chairman, members, thank you all very much for the opportunity to speak before you. I know Tuesday I spoke, there were several of you on another committee that I addressed, and so I'm basically going through the same thing, and so I apologize in advance for that, but that's what happens with overlapping committees and that sort of thing. With me today, I brought several members of our staff from the Department of Labor and Industry. The most important one, for your purposes, is John Rakowski, our lobbyist or our government affairs director. If you have questions at all that come up, or if you have constituent issues, I'd encourage you to talk to John or talk to me. John's cell phone number is 651-503-4592, or if you want to just call me, my cell phone number is 651-284-5010. John will do a good job for you, and I'll certainly do the best I can to help you out if you have any issues. I know that in some of the things we do, you do end up having constituent issues. We want to help you out as much as we possibly can. The Department of Labor Industry is first and foremost a regulatory agency. That's what we do. We regulate, we like to say in construction, we regulate everything behind the walls, under the floors, and above the ceiling. We also regulate workplace safety in our state, ensure proper reimbursement and medical care for those injured at work. We oversee on-the-job training through our apprenticeship program. And finally, in our newest responsibility, we make sure that participants in professional boxing and professional boxing and mixed martial arts are safe and aren't injured. I'm going to be just bouncing around from this document, which you've got in front of you. I'll be referring to it several times. It's not complete enough to be a full outline, but I will be referring to it with some of the numbers and that sort of thing, so you might be well advised to take a look at it. I'm not going to go through our budget at all in detail because you're not a budgetary committee, but also the governor will release his budget next week, and so we'll be addressing that at the proper place. But I will be mentioning some of our funding streams and that sort of thing, which I think help you understand our department, the work we do, a little bit better. First of all, just going through some of the numbers on the upper, the upper left-hand corner here of some of the things we do that just give you a sense of some of the stuff we do. The first number is, it says labor and industry by the numbers. The first one's 85%. That's percentage of mediated workers' compensation cases resolved by DLI mediators. We have 15 mediators who work in workers' comp areas, and they address about 1,100 cases a year. Some of these are full part of a case or other just small parts of a case, but they do a pretty good job. They're composed of with one former district court judge, number of former practitioners, lawyers, as well as some non-lawyers doing mediation. The next number is $50 million. That's the workers' compensation benefits paid annually for second injury and supplemental benefits. These are two benefits that went to workers who were injured prior to 1995. I don't need to go into the details of what they're for because we no longer have those benefits. The legislature in 1995 did away with those benefits, but we still owe people who were injured prior to that time, for injuries occurred before that time. And so we do assess through the workers' compensation assessment system to pay for those individuals. And last year we paid out $50 million. Over time, that number does drop. And by 2040, if any of us are here in 2040, they're probably all gone because those people will no longer either be dead or no longer eligible. The next number I have is 2,600, which is OSHA workplace inspections conducted annually. We have two. I'll go through this again in a little detail. We have two parts of OSHA. We have OSHA compliance, which are the people that go out and do inspections and find workplace hazards and may, in some cases, assess fines. We also have OSHA consultation, and there you can see that we do 1,700 there. Those are basically free safety consultations that we provide to employers that who see a need, that they need some help, but they do not work with our compliance section. They're completely walled off, so they just go and give employers some advice how she or he could make their workplace more safe, and they do it for free. The next number, we have 20,000 annual number of inquiries regarding wage and hour laws. That's our Fair Labor Standards Division, and we get 17,000 phone calls and 3,000 emails a year. People are asking about back wages, about minimum wage, child labor laws, that sort of thing. We try to, for the most part, if there's a back wage problem, if someone, an employer hasn't paid an employee, we try to reconcile it. We call the employer and ask them to pay up. And then if there's a dispute over whether or not the money is owed, we encourage people to go to conciliation court. Next number is registered apprentices supported by our department, 6,500. That number goes up and goes down depending on the economy. And I think in 2005 we had somewhere around 8,000 apprentices. And that dropped because of 85% of apprentices stayed are in the construction industry, and that dropped off because of the recession. It's going up now. And 125,000 individuals and businesses licensed in construction-related activities. We license electricians, plumbers, elevator installers, high-pressure piping people, and several other trades, contractors. And we give out about 125,000 of those a year. We made a real effort in the last few years to do those online, and we're making a lot of success with that, a lot of progress. Our final number there is 225,000 number of electrical inspections performed annually. We perform most of the electrical inspections in the state, although there are a number of communities that opt to have their own electrical inspections. Like Representative Uglum pointed out, when she was mayor of Champlin, that they opted to do it, and it's worked very successfully. Some communities want to do it, and they can make it work financially. Others don't want to do it for whatever reason. And for those that, then we take care of them. But that just goes to those numbers. Now let's go through the various units in more detail, Mr. Chairman, if that's okay.
Yep.
Workers' compensation is probably one of our biggest sections. And this year marks the 100th anniversary of Minnesota Workers' Compensation Law. It was passed in 1913. Workers' compensation is probably most of you aware of. It's basically a deal. It's an unwritten contract between management and labor. Labor gives up the right to sue a district court for personal injuries, and on the other hand, for that, employers are required to provide insurance. They don't get sued in district court for personal injuries, and they provide are mandated to provide workers' comp insurance that will cover cash benefits as well as for medical care for an on-the-job injury. And so that's basically the deal, and it's reflected even today. We have some of you members have served on and continue to serve on the Workers' Comp Advisory Commission, which is composed of 5 representatives from labor and 5 representatives from management, as well as 4 legislative ex officio members, which deals with workers' comp legislation every year. And before workers' comp legislation comes to the legislature, the agreement has been that it always goes through this committee and has approval from this committee. And that just sort of reflects that management and labor deal on it. And it's workers' comp can be a very contentious issue, so I think it's a good approach that's led to a lot of stability in the system over the last 15 years or so. We have several responsibilities in the workers' compensation system. 1, just basically keep all the records. 2, is ensuring compliance with the law. 3, provide alternative dispute resolutions, such as mediation, which I referred to. 4, to provide benefits to employees of uninsured employers. You know, a number of employers who don't get insurance. They may be smaller, they may be having financial trouble, they drop their insurance, an employee gets hurt, then we provide coverage for that individual, then try to recover as much money as we can from the employer who wasn't providing coverage. And the 5th thing we do, we pay second injury and supplementary benefits, which I just covered a few minutes ago. Those are the benefits incurred before 1995. We also, in many cases, provide vocational rehab to workers to help injured workers get back to work. The number of injuries have been dropping in Minnesota and also throughout the country. Part of that's related, I think, to just a difference in the way we do work. Those of you who've been on a factory floor over the last 20 years know that once there may have been 10 people on the assembly line, now there are 1 or 2, that we have lots of advantages of technology, workplaces are safer. I think a lot of employers have a higher consciousness. I'd like to think that our OSHA division has made some difference in that. But we do have about 30,000 injuries a year now. About 6,000 of those end up in disputes that for one reason or another they deny primary liability, saying the person wasn't injured at work, or there's a dispute over what the proper medical care should be, or that sort of thing. So we do have, there are about 20% end in disputes. Most people do not have disputes in their workers' comp claims, but some people do, and they're the ones you're going to hear about. The constituents call you up, and for both employers and employees, they're the ones that there's going to be some issues. We try to resolve many of them, but some go on to for trials at the Office of Administrative Hearings, where they have about, I think, 17 administrative law judges who specialize in workers' comp for a trial. Then they can appeal to the Workers' Comp Court of Appeals, and finally go to the Supreme Court for a decision. And every year, the Supreme Court has about 8 to 10 workers' comp decisions that come out. But the Workers' Comp Court of Appeals, a 5-member body, they handle most of the appellate work. They take care of it. Like I said, the trend is fewer injuries, but we're seeing a higher percentage of disputes. And I think in part that's because the costs are greater, particularly with medical care. As medical costs have gone up with workers' comp as well as everybody's health, that there's higher stakes, and so I think that there's simply more disputes over it. And there may be more disputes because of just different opinions on what the right approach to medical care might be. We're seeing higher costs per claims. The medical costs of the last couple years are moderating somewhat. They were going up a lot, but since about 2009, they've slowed down. And we think in part that's because of providers aren't charging as much, like they're feeling the recession. Also, we think that a lot of injured workers probably were not reporting problems they were having simply because they were afraid of losing their jobs because of the tight employment market. The medical costs certainly have moderated. But our overall costs are somewhere between $1.3 and $1.4 billion, and about 35% of that goes for medical costs. 31% goes to the insurers, just their administrative costs, their profits and administrative costs and reserves and all that sort of thing. 30% goes to indemnities. That's the cash payments that an individual worker would get. And about 2% go for rehab expenses. Our workers' comp division has 124.5 FDs. Basically, it's around 125. That'll go up and down as people leave or as people come in, but somewhere around 125 people. Like a lot of the agencies, we have we've adopted some performance measures just to check on how well we're doing. We have we keep a dashboard up on our website, and in our workers' comp area, the measurement we're using is one of them we're using is looking at national ratings, and I think that our workers' comp system's working pretty well. The national system looks at five key worker outcomes: incidence rates, that, you know, number of injuries, cases, missing work, median disability durations, delayed recoveries, and low back strains. And Minnesota's gives it a plus under this system, along with the states of Utah and Arizona. And the worst states, sort of, they don't seem to fit in any kind of category. Worst states are West Virginia, New York, Hawaii, Wyoming, and Kentucky. But we're some of the best, and I think we're doing a good job. That overall, we think it's a reasonably cost system that's helping people get back to work. It always needs improvement, but we think we have a reasonably good system. Next item I want to talk about is Minnesota OSHA. OSHA was set up in the early 1970s. The federal government passed a law setting it up, and Minnesota at that time opted for it to be called, it's called a state plan state. That is, we operate our own OSHA program. About 25 other states do that, and well, the rest of them just had the federal government do it. The chief reason for us doing it, as I understand it, was that we get more inspectors, more consultants, more people in the field, and kind of run our own program. Our penalties are by and large a little bit less than the federal penalties, although some cases are higher, but by and large are a little bit less. We've also tried to take on areas which seem to be more appropriate to Minnesota that we've had problems. For example, a couple years ago, we were leading. This is a terrible. At first, you think you laugh or laugh at it, but it's a terrible statistic. We were leading the country in window washer deaths. We had three window washers were killed in a four-year period, and for whatever reason. And so we gave new standards, required new buildings to have a place to tie off and that sort of thing. And if we had waited for the federal government to do that, it would be 15 years. And so we were able to do something. So we were able to be much more flexible. We do have, for example, we have a safe patient handling program, which works pretty well. We work with nursing homes and assisted livings to help people, you know, lift people out of aged and infirm, lift them out of bed, and all that sort of thing. We have a conference every year on that. That's been a pretty successful one. We have a crane. We just had a construction crane initiative lately. And some other areas. This last Tuesday, we had our first construction breakfast of the year. We bring in people from the construction industry and go through various issues. We do that about six or eight of them a year. The way it works is the federal government pays 50% of our OSHA compliance program. The state pays the other 50%, and that comes out of the workers' comp payments, right, workers' comp assessments, which we get. The federal government pays 90% of our consultation program, and the state pays 10%. And so that's a real bargain. That's a smaller one of the divisions. I think we have 16 or 17 people and about 75 people in the OSHA compliance division. But that's how the payment breaks down, though. None of the money comes out of the general fund. Our performance measures that we're using there, or also I should point out, after those terrible shootings at that company in Minneapolis, the sign company, those terrible shootings last fall, we did organize a number of sessions on violence in the workplace, and we're continuing to work on that because it's such a terrifying thing for people to see. Well, it's a terrible thing to happen, but also trying to help people recognize individuals who might be subject to doing that sort of thing and knowing what to do in the event there is an outbreak. And so we've been working quite hard on that, trying to prevent any other of those terrible things. But as you can imagine, not as predictable as we'd like. Our performance measure there is we're trying to reduce the fatality rates. We lose around 25 people a year to fatalities. That's excluding car traffic accidents. But we have dropped that by 25% from the five-year average of the last year. We also increased our number of consultations with small employers to 96%. Those are for employers less than 250 people. We think that's small employers are the ones that we have the most problems with in terms of fatalities and serious accidents. A lot of the bigger firms are able to provide their own safety programs, hire their own safety personnel, and do a better job. But a smaller firm, they have trouble. Their margins might be tighter, and they simply may not have the staff to provide the safety personnel. So we do want to help them as much as possible and to prevent injuries there. And a lot of fatalities, interestingly enough, are just from these two or three or four or five-person shops, maybe a construction company that does digging a trench or something, and they really don't know what they're doing as well as they should sometimes. So we want to reach those people and help them. Next division, and all these, please, none of you are shrinking violence. Please feel free to ask any questions as I go through this. The next area I want to go through is labor standards. That's the one area in our department that's not funded through the general, that's funded through the general fund, not funded through fees or through assessments or federal dollars. We have 11 employees there, and there we work on enforcement of state laws governing minimum wage, overtime, child labor, employee rights regarding termination and wages due and overtime, breaks, that sort of thing. That's a group we get about 20,000 inquiries a year, trying to help people out as much as we can. We also provide, we do a lot of outreach to employer groups, community groups, business groups, that sort of thing, talking what we do. And this group also puts together prevailing wage information every 2 years for and investigates prevailing wage violations. Our performance measures there, we served last year 63,901 employees, and we covered $1.96 million in back wages that people owe. So we think we're a successful group there that is working pretty well. Apprenticeship is another division we have, and that's apprenticeship is one of the things I think as a nation we have not done as good of a job on as we could have, and maybe I'm not sure we can do much about it now because of the way we do things, but if you look at Germany, what they've done with apprenticeship, they have 225 occupations, which are apprenticeships. Mm-hmm. Basically, in order to join much of the workforce, you've got to go through an apprenticeship in Germany, basically on-the-job training. It works very well for them. And the United States, though, it's mostly apprenticeships, but mostly in the construction areas. We are working in some manufacturing and some of the other areas, but we're set up a little differently. We haven't done as much. But I do think on-the-job training is a very effective way to train people how to do things. We run that. We have one of our measurements there is registered apprentices are women and minorities. Now it's at 24%, which is a little higher than it's been in the past. The next area we have is construction code and licensing. That's our department's single biggest unit. In 2005, Governor Plenty joined a number of these licensing places that were scattered around the state, the electrical board, the plumbing board, boiler inspections. They put them all in our department. And so that's what we call the construction code and licensing division. So they provide licenses for people, electrical permits, and also do codes. Right now we're going through the process of updating the residential and construction building codes, our energy code, and our accessibility codes. So we do that every 3 to 6 years. So we're going through that process right now. We inspect elevators, electrical installations, plumbing, high pressure piping, boilers, manufactured homes, and boats for hire. There are about 60 to 70 boats for hire, mostly on Lake Mille Lacs, Minnetonka, and Leech, that we inspect every year to make sure they're operating fine. Not just an accident of history that we got that thing. We do those inspections. Like I said, we do 225,000 electrical inspections a year. We also review plans for new public buildings and working on codes. We have 139 employees there. Performance measurements there is the number of number of electrical permits issued online. Electrical permit is just the thing that tells you the electrician can go ahead and put in the wiring. You usually do two of them, one before you put in the, you do the rough in one, then before you put in the walls, then you do one at the end. So there are usually two inspections that go on. Sometimes they're more complicated facilities, going to be more. But anyway, a number of last year, 50% of our electrical permits were issued online. That's been a big increase. So people don't have to send something in and it sits on someone's desk or it's passed around, comes in online, we're able to get back to them within a few days. And we think that's we have a very good reaction from the industry on that. And then the percentage of licenses renewed online, that's up to 25%. It's interesting, some of these trades do more, but plumbers, I don't know if anybody here is a plumber, but plumbers do a very good job. We have 85% of all plumbers registered online. Electricians a lot lower. So talk to your plumber, talk to your electrician, find out who's really works with their computers. I don't know. But anyway, it is funny that plumbers do a much better job on responding to that than electricians. Our newest, as I said earlier, we have Last year, the legislature gave us a combative sports office. It used to be called the Combative Sports Commission that governs mixed martial arts and professional boxing. We only have one full-time employee as well as a number of part-time employees who do they work maybe 4 hours a week or something. They work at a fight, make sure that the wrappings are done properly, make sure no one's cheating, that sort of thing. And that there are only performance measures that we don't have any serious injuries to tell, which we haven't. There are about somewhere between 40 and 50 events every year. Like there's a boxing match this weekend. So that covers, then we have also the general support division, and that does the stuff that accounting, finance, that sort of thing. What that covers our areas. I wanted, if it's okay with you, Mr. Chairman, just to talk a little bit about our budget. Just quickly go through it so you get a sense of it, how it works, that sort of thing.
You can wind it up within 5 minutes. And
here's our last front page. Front page, you got what our, there's a graph here, just says what our, says where we get the source of our funds. You can see the biggest one is workers' compensation, and most of that money is going for insurance benefits, 71%. The construction codes are paid for by fees. That you have an electrician's license, you pay a fee. Next one is federal funds, 4%, special revenues. We have a number of programs that just go, the money goes in and goes out. We have a log safe program, for example, that we assess the mills, and that provides for training for loggers in the field. And that just the industry has decided to go ahead and just handle its own stuff, and we just administer that program. And then the general fund is less than 1%. We do a lot of, most of our money is spent externally. Just on the final page here, I'll just quickly just point out some numbers there. This thing right here, this just breaks down in terms of external and internal. If you see right across the top, DLI agency total. If you look at the last two columns, one's a total, it's the internal operations, that's $50 million per year. External is we have $92 million a year that goes out for various other things. The workers' comp assessment that we do give on employers has been, like I said earlier, has been going down, but that also pays for operations of our workers' comp division, the Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals, and the Office of Administrative Hearings, as well as a grant that goes through money that goes to the Department of Commerce for fraud investigations. Mr. Chairman, I think that I'm certainly going to have any questions you may have or comments.
Very good. A lot of information. I'm sure, like you said, people can contact you offline to you or Mr. Rajowski. But we do have members with a few questions here. Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Peterson, one of the issues that we can all relate to is the workman's comp issue, where I'm certain everybody on this committee could bring a story to tell about denial of claims, and that seems to be the practice. Whenever someone is injured, they're automatically denied. Can you speak to the percentage of claims that are automatically denied, and then also speak to the percentage of fraudulent claims that you've recognized, and I'll save my other 13 questions for another day.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sedin, members. I don't know about, as I said, there's about 30,000 workers' comp claims a year. About 6,000 are disputed. I'm not sure any insurance company automatically denies them. They certainly may. I don't know how they operate. But it's up to the insurance company whether they determine whether or not an accident occurred at work, or if the accident, the injury occurred before the individual was employed at a given place, or what there are also disputes on medical care as to what the proper form of medical care should be. But there are often a lot of disputes. If I think that's your question, that any kind of, if we do see an insurance company that's just turning down everybody, we'll take a look at them and go after them. But for the most part, there may be some rejections, but I'm not sure that insurance companies would want to do it that way, that would automatically deny anybody. I also don't think it's in their interest.
Follow-up, Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Out of those 6,000 that are disputed, can you give me an idea on where those fell? You know, were the claimants compensated, or did the insurance company prevail on something like that?
Commissioner Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dean, members. I can give you more detail, and I will provide more details of what we do look at this every year. I don't have the numbers right in the top of my head. What happens is, so many of these disputes end up, it's hard to tell what happens to some of them, because a lot of them are settled, but they may be settled for less than what the individual wanted, or the dispute may just be on medical care and not on indemnities, or maybe on the type of injury it may be, whether it's a permanent total injury or temporary total, permanent partial, that sort of thing. So you get a wide variety of disputes and responses to them. But in terms of the number of wins and losses, wins and losses, I think that's what you're referring to. I don't have those numbers. I'll get them to you. I'll probably get as best I can with them. I don't mean to sort of drag you around dance you around the. I read all the numbers. I'll see what I can do.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, Commissioner Peterson, can you break down the numbers as far as workman's comp claims? How much money is paid out for medical claims, and how much is for actually time lost, wages, that type of thing?
About, Commissioner, Mr. Chairman, Representative Dean, members, that if you, our total costs are about $1.4 billion in the system. About 35% of that total number, which I suppose would be around $300 to $400 million, would be medical costs. And then 30% would go to wage loss and indemnity payments. So medical care is the biggest number, then the other numbers of indemnity, and also there's about a third of that money, 31%, goes to insurance companies for their operations and for their profits.
Very good.
Thank you.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chairman. I can't see you. Could you move just a little bit so I can see the commissioner? Thank you so much. Thank you, Commissioner, for coming in today. I actually am an owner of a subcontracting business, and so these questions come out of my own experience and also from those in the trades around me that I've been asked to bring forth. Something that happened in the last legislative session was that all subcontractors now have to register with Dolly. Do you know how many subcontractors you now have? You had mentioned in this 125,000, you've got the businesses and licensed in the construction industry, but do you know how many subcontractors you now have registered?
Commissioner Pearson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative O'Neill, I don't know, but Jessica Lumen is our assistant commissioner in charge of that area, and she does know, and so I'll ask her to come up. Yeah, she better know.
Yes, she better.
And if you'd identify yourself before you give the information.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members. My name is Jessica Lumen. I'm the Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Labor and Industry, and I oversee the labor standards divisions as well as the construction codes and licensing division. And to respond to your question, we now have about 7,200 subcontractors registered under the contractor registration program.
Great. Thank you.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you.
Follow up.
Thank you, Chairman. Chairman. So something that has come to my attention through the trades is a new practice, and collectively either my family or my brother-in-law has been involved in the Aragone family, so they've been in construction for 50, 60 years. So I'm kind of pulling together all of our experience, but I've been told that over that time period this has not happened, that this is a new practice. And the practice is that subcontractors are being audited, and if they have two-thirds of their work coming from one particular either other subcontractor or general contractor, that they are now being told that they are now employees of either that other subcontracting business or that general contractor, and that the other, all of the things that go along with having employees now are in play. Can you speak to that? Because that's anecdotally what I'm hearing from my industry.
Ms. Luna?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I haven't heard about that. And the process, so that's not being done by the Department of Labor and Industry. That kind of auditing process is not being done by the Department of Labor and Industry. What we're doing with the pilot project related to the subcontractor registration is we are looking for the misclassification of workers and misclassifying them as independent contractors. However, we have maintained the nine-factor test that has always been in place.
Thank you.
Related to what a legitimate business is versus what an independent contractor being misclassified is. Mm-hmm. And that's the test that we continue to use at the Department of Labor and Industry.
Thank you. Just a quick follow-up.
Very good. One more follow-up.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Because, I have actually those nine in front of me, and nowhere does it say anything about two-thirds time. The last question I have is related to workman's compensation, and as owners, we have to pay in $650 or $700 or so into the workman's compensation plan, but receive no benefit. And can you speak to why that would be?
Commissioner Peterson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative O'Neill, members. I think what you're referring to is the assessment that's paid, that goes on top of your insurance bill that comes from the state. And that's paying for the supplementary benefits, the second injury funds that the state still owes for injuries incurred prior to 1995. That number will decrease as time goes along as those people, their benefits expire. You're also paying for employers who are uninsured. You're paying for every employer in the state is covering the cost of those people who aren't paying for it, who are the deadbeats, who aren't doing what they're supposed to be doing, and so you end up paying for it. We try to recover as much money as we can in those cases, but in some cases there's no money left. So we have two lawyers that spend almost full time going chasing down those people, but sometimes there's nothing there to get. So a large part of that, the rest of it goes to funding the workers' compensation system in OSHA. So I think that's referring to your $600.
Yes.
Yep. Very good. Thank you, Representatives. Was that to this point? Okay, we'll get to you then. Representative Simonson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, my question is about application of the Minnesota State Building Code. I understand that there's a number of jurisdictions across the state that employ their own building official and essentially administer the Minnesota State Building Code in their own jurisdictions, which, of course, they can't be more restrictive than the State Building Code. But my specific question is, and I live in a city where we do employ a building official and we do enforce the code, but the question that I get so many times from constituents is about how it is that in my city we enforce this code and how they have to have these permits and follow these pesky regulations, and they can go right across the street into a neighboring unorganized township where there is no building official local. And my answer has always been that the state building code is the state building code, whether you're on this side of the road or that side of the road. But to my question, how do you enforce the code in those unorganized areas? And maybe just elaborate on that a little bit.
Ms. Luna?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, so the Department of Labor and Industry develops and administers the State Building Code. And the State Building Code, as you know, it does apply to the state. However, the Department of Labor and Industry doesn't have authority over the building code enforcement except for in very specific areas. We have statewide authority for enforcement for electrical installations, and that's why we're responsible for the process that we were talking about that the commissioner referred to earlier. And we have the inspection authority for buildings that are state-owned and licensed for building code enforcement as well as plumbing code enforcement. And we have statewide authority for elevators. We have statewide authority for high-pressure piping. But we don't have statewide authority for building. That is something that has been reserved to the local communities who have taken on that role. So what we do, because we don't have enforcement authority, we don't have inspection authority. What we do is we do have enforcement authority. So in the event that there is a violation of the state building code or state licensing responsibilities, we have an enforcement division that works to correct those and identify contractors that are working in violation of the codes. And so we have an enforcement authority. The other piece we do is a lot of outreach and education to local communities and make sure that they understand the scope of the code and how to enforce it.
Very good. Representative Mason?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions, but I think what I'll do is I'll just make one comment. Yesterday, as they had mentioned that there was an 8-story building in Egypt that collapsed, and they said that's not untypical there just because they have so lax codes and enforcement. So we're very fortunate here. My question goes to the comment you had made previously about people going back to work after they have been out regarding, you know, with some type of mishap. Who actually has the, and I know it gets dicey, but who makes the ultimate authority when somebody goes back to work or is able to go back to work?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mason, members. Generally, it's going to be up to the employer and the employee. Oftentimes, sadly enough, I mean, most people are on her of the job go back to work. However, sometimes the for whatever reason, the relationship becomes frayed, that there's a dispute, the employer may not trust the employee anymore, and so in those cases they may make a settlement. That one of the conditions of settlement is the employee loses their job. That often happens. I'm always surprised at those. I'm shocked at them, but it does happen. But generally the employer is supposed to take someone back to work as long as they can do a job that they have. And so generally you try to find a job at the employer's place of business where they can do something. Like, oftentimes a construction business. You'll see someone who no longer can be a laborer, but they may be able to work in the office or maybe go out and do estimates or something like that. So you try to find some place for somebody. But in some cases the injury is so severe that they really can't, and they become, if they're more than 17% disabled, they are they receive a permanent total, and so they would be on permanent disability basically. And so in those cases they will just be disabled, they won't be working there at that place or may not work in any place.
Representative Mason, follow up? One follow
just
up
one
and
question.
A couple other people.
And I'll use the illustration of somebody that I know. She had the carpal tunnel and was her doctor saying that she can't go back, but yet she was being encouraged to go back to work, and that's the kind of situations that I'm.
Hopefully, with
Commissioner Peterson.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, Representative Mason. Hopefully, in those cases, say she, I don't know what she was doing, but say she was doing, say a cashier. You often see people cashier wearing braces, and maybe she can't do that kind of work. Hopefully, they'd find another job for her, someplace else in the building where she could do the work. But if the individual doesn't think they can work, they can receive permanent partial. If they get a permanent partial rating, they can just receive workers' compensation benefits in that work.
Representative Euclid.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I have a two-part question for you regarding OSHA. The safety consultations, you mentioned that that's completely walled off from the enforcement division. I'm hoping you can elaborate on that. And then secondly, I think there's a lot of particularly small business people that are very afraid of OSHA, and they're not going to pick up the phone and call OSHA for a consultation. What are you doing to combat that negative perception? Because obviously you can bring a lot of value to the table with something like that.
Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner Peterson.
To answer the first part of your question, they are completely walled off. There's almost like a completely different culture in our consultation division as is in our compliance division. Often the people in the consultation are more experienced, they're older, they may not have quite as gung-ho of an attitude, maybe less of kind of a law enforcement attitude, more of a help people along attitude. And so we do keep them walled off. They can't talk to each other unless they go onto a site and they're just imminent danger. They see something's going to happen, that someone's going to die or a serious injury's going to occur, then they'll take some action. For the most part, they're completely walled off. We are trying, we're advertising, we send people out all the time trying to talk to to employer groups, to business groups, and I think this consultation is a great deal.
Yeah.
You can bring down your workers' comp costs, and also just in terms of the sheer humanity of it, have fewer injuries. Just don't hurt people. So I think it's a good deal. And I wish I could, and I just wish I could somehow get in people's brains that there's no danger to them. But I certainly understand that people are going to be concerned and think, they'll say that, but they don't really mean it. We do mean it, but it's a hard obstacle to overcome. I agree with you, but we're trying the best we can.
Very good. I got one last question before we end the meeting. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Out of deference to the time, that's I'll make my request to the Assistant Commissioner after the meeting.
Perfect.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, members, for a good discussion. We'll be reconvening next week to look up some of the broadband issues. With that, the meeting is adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members. Good.